Welcome to a time when there were no guitars and no drums, just synthesizers. It was the 1970s. The place was Britain, and our heroes were a maverick bunch of young pioneers, obsessed by Kraftwerk and science fiction. All across the country, these synthetic dreamers would imagine the very sound of the future yesterday. And by the 80s, their dreams would become a reality as Britain went synth-pop. Welcome to a time when machines ruled the world. By the 1970s, we were living in the future. Our cities were going space age. Victorian slums had been torn down and replaced by ultra-modern concrete high-rises. Entertainment also looked to the future. Our cinema and television screens were full of tantalizing glimpses of a future that seemed just around the corner. Released in 1971, Stanley Kubrick's Clockwork Orange was a futuristic and violent vision of concrete Britain that captured the zeitgeist. The film's soundtrack was composed by American synth pioneer Walter, now Wendy Carlos. It would have a profound effect on a generation of would-be musicians.
That was probably a lot of people's maybe first time they'd heard electronic music, you know, on the score to that film. It made me forever associate classical music with people getting their heads kicked in, which is kind of a bit strange.
The soundtrack to Clockwork Orange, fantastic synth sounds in that, you know, Big Moog synthesizer that Wendy Carlos used. And they were all orchestrated.
Well, Wendy, who then said she was Walter, I've never quite worked out what was going on there, was an absolute inspiration, you know. And the first time we'd ever heard that sort of absorbent synth-based sound, just raved about it.
Some of the people who would be the future post-punk people would listen to the three or four sort of original compositions that Carlos did on that soundtrack that were much more sinister and foreboding. There was a kind of a linkage made there between those sounds and the idea of a cold future, a bleak future, and that probably sort of sunk quite deeply into the psyche of a lot of young musicians at that time.
For a generation of electronic dreamers, Carlos's soundtrack would offer a glimpse of an alienated, synthetic future. But the true divine spark would arrive on our television screens in 1975. Tomorrow's World gave Britain its first glimpse of Kraftwerk, a German band who played only electronic instruments. They would invade our shores later the same year.
We played one of our first gigs, 1975, of our English tour in Liverpool. the Wings Over Britain tour was playing the same night in the town. That was also the reason why our hall was only half crowded. All of our posters were stuck right next to the posters of the Wings, so it made us proud, of course, you know.
Amazingly, they came to Liverpool in October of 75, and I sat in seat Q36 and witnessed the first day of the rest of my life. 75 was all, you know, the era of long hair and flared trousers and guitar solos, and these guys all came out in suits and ties. Two of them looked like they were playing electronic tea trays with wired up knitting needles, and I was just blown away. It was incredible.
We had no long hair, we didn't wear blue jeans, we had suits on, grey suits, short hair, you know, and we looked like the children of Wernher von Braun or Wernher von Siemens. And we saw us so, you know, engineer musicians like that, instead of dancing boys on stage to arouse the girls, you know. The interesting thing afterwards, there was a knock at our backstage door. It was a band. They were called Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark. And the leader, Eddie McCluskey, was really astonished and happy that he was meeting us in person. And he said, "You know, guys, you have shown us the future. This is it. We throw away our guitars tomorrow and buy all synthesizers."
In terms of inspiring people to not just have a synthesizer in their rock band, but to be completely electronic, I think you can never underestimate the impact of Kraftwerk. Trans-Europe Express had the same impact on the synth poppers that Anarchy in the UK had on people who wanted to be punk rockers.
Next year, Kraftwerk hoped to eliminate the keyboards altogether and build jackets with electronic lapels, which can be played by touch.
In British music in the mid-70s, the synth was a remote beast. Although they would become much cheaper later in the decade, a synthesizer then could cost as much as a small house. They were associated with rich and technically gifted progressive musicians.
Until punk came along, you had to be Keith Emerson. If you wanted to be in a band, you had to have learnt your instrument for at least 8 or 9 years before you would dare come out and play it. And it was simply the inspiration of The Damned and The Clash that said, get up and do it, you know? Do your best. If it's crap, maybe the simplicity will get you through.
Whilst the music didn't concern itself with synthesizers, the attitude of the punk movement would inspire those with an interest in electronic music to do it themselves.
All the infrastructure around punk we absolutely loved. It's just that the actual music we saw as being quite old-fashioned. And being a bit of a one-trick pony. So what we did was we took the attitudes of punk and gave it a different context, i.e. let's make music that nobody's heard before.
Across the country, small pockets of experimentation surfaced, inspired primarily by punk and Kraftwerk.
We're in my studio at home in southeast London. One day I opened my email inbox and it was like 10 emails from a very disparate bunch of people saying, you've got to go to eBay now and buy this. And what it was Kraftwerk's original vocoder, which was being sold on eBay. And it was the one that was used on Autobahn. I thought, well, this is the equivalent for a guitarist of getting Jimi Hendrix's guitar that was used on Purple Haze or something, you know. I first got a synthesizer in 1977. And I bought a second-hand Korg 700S from Macari's music shop in Charing Cross Road. The thing that pissed me off about punk was that you had to learn three chords to be in a punk band. If you had a synthesizer, all you had to do is press one key with a finger, you know.
I don't need a TV screen. I just stick the aerial into my skin.
Advances in technology in the late 70s heralded the invention of the affordable synth, costing no more than an electric guitar. Daniel Miller used his to form The Normal, an experimental act that supported punk groups. Miller drew on the work of English author J.G. Ballard, whose Crash was another futuristic vision of Britain.
Warm. Leatherette. Warm. Leatherette.
I'd just broken up with a girlfriend who, you know, I was very much in love with, and a friend of mine said, I'll read this book, I don't know. And I read it, and it's really had a huge, I don't want to use all these puns, like impact, but it's had a huge impact on me.
See the breaking glass in the underpass.
It wasn't like science fiction in the sense that it was outer space and stuff like that. It felt like it was 5 minutes into the future, and I loved that aspect of it, the fact that it was kind of so outrageous but so possible at the same time.
Leatherette.
Warm Leatherette by The Normal. The Normal was the alias of Daniel Miller.
Hear the crushing steel.
The lyrics are just a précis of some of the concepts in Crash, Ballard's novel, which was about people who have car accidents and find that thereafter their sexuality has been diverted and they are obsessed with being turned on by car crashes. So, you know, the lyric, like, the handbrake penetrates your thigh. Quick, let's make love before you die.
Warm.
The music was supposed to be visual, you know, like driving along a highway with big buildings either side and going into a tunnel. There's quite a lot of humour in it, really. I mean, it wasn't meant to be, like, apocalyptic or dystopian.
Leatherette. Warm.
Miller was one of Britain's first synth punks, and he wasn't alone. In the north of England, a bunch of computer programmers dreamt of a similar future.
Well, we love J.G. Ballard, and in fact, you know, Roxy had a song to HB about Humphrey Bogart, and we had a song for J.G., which was about J.G. Ballard.
The future were a bunch of sci-fi nerds from Sheffield. They formed in 77 and played only synthesizers.
When I bought my Korg 700S in 1976, it was the first time there was a monophonic synthesizer which you could do stuff with, which was kind of domestic level, entry level in terms of price. It was 350 quid, I think. And I remember distinctly thinking at the time, I was a computer operator, and there was a decision day where it was either buy a second-hand car and learn to drive, or go and buy this monophonic synthesizer. And that proved to be quite a fateful day, because I still can't drive, but I still got that synthesizer.
This is a Mini Korg 700S, and was sort of the first affordable synth. A fantastic machine, completely eccentric.
Listen to the voice of Buddha.
They give you a book of patches with it, and because it was Japanese, that there would be things like Synthy Cat or Funny Frog, you know, and you can't follow why it's doing what it does, but it sounds great.
Usually with a synthesizer, you can get it to do something for you that you don't have to be manually good at all. That was why we turned to them in the first place, because no one could learn how to do the guitars either, because we'd all tried. My brother's a great guitarist, and he tried to teach me. It just hurts your hand. So we use these things, and you can press a switch on them, and they'll do things for about 10 minutes. It's quite interesting. If you've got a tape recorder, you can put it down, put something next to it, and it'll sound all right.
The day that I joined the band, Martin came around to my house, and he had two records under his arm. One was Trans Europe Express, and one was I Feel Love. And he said, "Look, we can do this." I think that was his actual phrase.
We loved all that stuff. I mean, like the concept albums that George Moroder did with Donna Summer.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
We used to play those continuously. And this wasn't some kind of post-gay ironic thing. It's just because they sounded great and interesting, and you're never really sure what the next set of sounds coming up was going to be.
I feel that it just didn't sound like any record that had been before. It came on the radio and you couldn't quite believe what you were hearing. It was hypnotic, but it was driving.
Moroder's Moog Music was the disco single of 77. Its success would set the template for the future of the future.
We were, in fact, much more influenced by Moroder than we were by Kraftwerk. Everyone, ever since anyone that knows we use synths, you sound like Kraftwerk, don't you? Well, we use the same instruments, so some of the sounds are a bit the same. We never really wanted to be Kraftwerk. We wanted to be a pop band.
We wanted to embody a sense of futurism without being so literal. And it just so happened a friend of ours, he had bought for him this science fiction board game called Star Force. And it was prodigiously tedious. I mean, it was real geek stuff. And it was impenetrable. You couldn't play it. There was the Rise of the Human League or something. And we thought, the Human League, that is such a cool name. No future, they say.
The Human League set out to make electronic pop for the modern city. Now it's calling, the city is human. Blind you take hope, you're no jokes of your time is cubic, but come so we've had it easy, we should be glad. High rise living's not so bad. The Human League had a totally different spin on synthesizers, where it was much more like this bright, technocratic optimism thing. And in fact, in one of their early songs, Blind Youth, you know, they make fun of people who go on about dehumanization. Dehumanization is such a big word. It's been around since Richard the Third. Dehumanization, it's easy to say, but if you're not a hermit, you know the city's okay.
I'd say most of the brightness came from Martin. Martin's very optimistic, and if anyone's moaning about anything, Martin will go and write a song in the opposite direction. I think I felt a bit gloomy about the concrete jungle and everything, which is ridiculous, because I'm a townie. You know, I gravitate towards concrete. If you put me in the country, I would just find the nearest town and go, and I'll be sitting in a bar quite quickly. Blind you take hope, you're no
joke, so your time is too big, but come soon. Unfortunately, British pop music wasn't quite ready for a synth-led group of futurists just yet. But in 1978, the Human League weren't the only group experimenting with electronics in Sheffield.
This is the old Salter Line Art College, which used to be part of Sheffield Polytechnic in the 1970s. I believe the Human League also played this very place for their first ever live show in Sheffield. Cabaret Voltaire did perform in this very room. Yeah, I mean, we just thought there was nothing for us, you know. I mean, it was all kind of bloated super groups and progressive bands who weren't even from the same kind of social backgrounds, you know. They were probably public school educated, whereas I think, you know, most of the scene in Sheffield was pretty solid, kind of working class. You'd find little bits of interesting music within perhaps some of the prog rock stuff, where there'd be a weird little synth break. But then, you know, once you kind of start to discover all the German bands, you realise that there were entire albums that were made of electronics.
Whilst the Human League dreamt of pop, Cabaret Voltaire were anything but, using electronics to explore Sheffield, a city torn between the past and the future.
I remember watching loads of science fiction things in the 60s, like Doctor Who and things like Quatermass. And all these kind of strange things seemed to happen in kind of old gasworks or industrial environments.
there was an otherworldliness about it. You might see an alien or a giant blob creeping across the floor, glowing bright green from radioactivity.
Very arty group. They, obviously, the name echoes Dada. They were really into William Burroughs and his ideas of, like, control and surveillance. They actually used quite a lot of guitar, but it was so heavily processed it didn't sound like rock and roll guitar. It sounded more like a synthesizer. They also put synthesizing type effects on the voice, which is probably one of the most disturbing things they did. You know, they have a guy singing, but it sounds more like a Dalek than, you know, a human being.
At night time, you'd hear distant booming noises, which, you know, would probably be something like a drop forge or steam hammer or something. You certainly knew that you were on the edge of, you know, heavy industry.
Everything in their music was kind of alienated, and, you know, the music that comes from people who are kind of divorced from any kind of natural life, any natural rhythms, the music for a kind of hostile environment.
If I've ever been asked to explain that movement, I always call it the alienated synthesists. And, you know, Throbbing Gristle, Cabaret Voltaire, Joy Division, who were a little bit less obviously synthy. Everyone was sort of like that. We were all going around in long coats from second-hand shops and saying how terrible things were with the synth.
Across the Pennines, another pocket of alienated synthesists dreamt of an electronic future in the spiritual home of British pop music.
We are in Matthew Street in Liverpool, and I'm actually standing outside of the door to what used to be Eric's Club, which is where we played our first gig, where we invented OMD to play at this place. And it was, of course, the club where we all used to come. The Bunnymen and the Teardrops played within a month of us playing here as well. This was a place I saw Devo play their first English concert, and all of the influential bands that we could get to come to town played here, apart from Kraftwerk, who played the big theatre down the road. And then literally 10 yards away is the Cavern Club. You've got Eric's and the Cavern right across the road from each other. When Paul and I started being interested in electronic music, we were very young. We had no money, and it was totally unrealistic to think about getting, you know, the big kind of keyboards that you saw on TV or on stage with some of the keyboard players in the 70s. My mother had a Kay's mail order catalogue, and they had some synthesizers. Our first Korg micro preset was bought from my mother's catalogue for 36 weeks at $7.76 a week, I seem to recall.
This was the first synth, and we'd made the first two albums with this, you know, and it's like, it's quite a basic synth. Can you believe that's the record?
The major record labels largely ignored synth music, forcing bands like OMD to look to newly formed indies instead. In 1978, OMD would sign to Factory. A movement of sorts was beginning to coalesce.
I think the first wave of bands that sort of came out of the closet in the late 70s, we were all working independently of each other. There was no unified movement. It didn't all start in one club or one town. There was no gang of people who all had a manifesto that we were going to do the new British electronic music. It was small pockets of people in different parts of the country who were independently, obviously, listening to the same things.
I did make an electronic drum machine, but I'd seen Kraftwerk with their sticks, so I thought, I can make one of those, and so I did. And so some of the early sort of synth drums were this sort of very Heath Robinson-looking box with all these plates on there with these sort of sticks with wires that we did the drums to electricity.
horrified when Tony Wilson said, you know, what you do is the future of pop. Right, pop? You know, we're experimental, German-influenced. You know, we're not pop at all. How dare you call us pop? We were absolutely mortified. We couldn't see it at all. Totally by accident, Paul and I, and I guess others at the time, had distilled the electronic experimentation and the kind of glam pop of Britain from just a few years earlier into what was going to become, which didn't seem at the time, but was going to become the future of pop music.
By the start of 1979, the future of pop music seemed a long way off, as the combined efforts of The Normal, OMD and the Human League had failed to trouble the charts. But dabbling in synthesizers was becoming increasingly de rigueur, even for dyed-in-the-wool punks. At the other end of the East Lancs Road, another factory band, who would become one of the greatest electronic acts, were taking their first synthetic steps.
The first synthesizer we had in Joy Division was a little thing called Transcendent 2000, and I actually built it from a load of components. At the time, I had insomnia, I couldn't sleep very well. So I used to get this magazine called Electronics Today or something like that. And in it was this synthesizer. And if you were to buy one in those days, it was incredibly expensive. And we didn't have any money. So I thought, well, this is really cheap. It's only like 200 quid. And how difficult can it be to build it? And it was like soldering components in, you know, by hand. It took about 2 months of doing that. And then it didn't work incredibly well, you know. I remember we went to write a track in a studio called Cargo in Rochdale, and when we went in, we found a little Woolworths organ that you switched the battery power, switched it on and it blew a fan. You could play chord buttons on it, so I was messing about with these chord buttons, and then Martin Hannett, I think, had brought in a Selena string synth, and you can play more than one note at a time on it. So I got the organ and the synthesizer and hit these chord buttons and wrote Atmosphere, Joy Division track, and just seemed to write it there in the studio. I think we wrote the music, and then Ian wrote the words that night and then recorded the vocals the next day, which is amazing when I think about it now.
Whilst it seemed the North had the lead in post-punk synth pioneers, things were also stirring down south. John Fox was the former lead singer of Ultravox. He worked in Shoreditch, in London's then unfashionable East End.
These modular synths were the first generation, really, of working synthesizers. And then the companies decided to make a cheap version of it because no one could afford these, or very few people could afford those. And they condensed all that down into this. London seemed almost empty in the 70s. I used to walk around the streets and there were newspapers blowing around and a car in the distance and grey concrete walls, and everything seemed gritty and lost somehow, like we lost direction. And I wonder what that was about. I wasn't angry about it anymore, as we were supposed to be as punks. I just wanted to make music for it, the kind of music that I could hear.
Standing in the dark, watching you glow. Nobody I know.
underpass is such a Ballardian idea, you know, the underpass with the sodium lights and you might be mugged, and it's, you know, very 70s dystopian, the spectral city.
This was the industrial bit of London that has served the docks and done some manufacturing, and both of which have gone. It was like living in a Quatermass movie, because I realised and discovered that underneath all this area are the plague pits where the bodies were thrown. So that inevitably leaks into the music. That's why a lot of my music's so dark, I think. It's because I come from Lancashire. And where did I end up but in a place even more sinister?
Fox's music wasn't the only synthetic portrait of the 70s metropolis. An experimental group of artists known as Throbbing Gristle had been forging their own electronic industrial sounds in their death factory down the road in Hackney.
Grim.
Yeah, it was grim. It was very run down. The factory was an old trouser factory, and it was near London Fields, and in the basement, we were on level with the plague pits. That's why it got called the death factory. There was still a lot of sort of antagonism left over from, I know it sounds like unbelievable, post-war, because there were still people there, like the park keeper, used to be one of Moses Brown's shirts.
I mean, it sounds a bit of a cliche now, but at the time we were trying to sort of reflect the sounds around us in some weird way. Our studio was in like an industrial area, and there were lots of different noises going on all the time. And we were sort of trying to reflect all these sounds and the way they all come together into like this weird mishmash of electronic experimental textures. Kinship with a lot of bands, didn't we? Especially sort of Sheffield bands. And
yeah, Cabaret Voltaire, those people. Yeah. But I think the kinship was the fact that we were all independent.
Yeah.
Chris Carter in Throbbing Gristle was a sort of nut for Tangerine Dream and that kind of music. So they were aware sort of some hypnotic, dreamy, electronic Throbbing Gristle tracks that were actually quite sort of pretty in a funny sort of shape and way.
And I had these synths. And because they were homemade synths, they weren't bought sort of off the shelf, they weren't Rolands and Korgs, they sounded quite unique anyway. They didn't sound like regular synths. And then I built this effects unit. I saw this design in Practical Electronics, and you could combine all the effects together and put a guitar through it or a voice or anything. So I started building these units for Throbbing Gristle and called them Gristleizers. We were never punk, we're not punk, we were industrial. We were an industrial experimental music band.
Come 1979, British electronic music was still being ignored by mainstream labels. So Dan Miller founded Britain's first electronic indie, Mute, to release recordings by Kindred Spirit, Bad Gadget, as well as his own work.
I wasn't interested in rock and rock music at all at that point. I really only was interested in electronic music. And I thought that was the future of where exciting music was going to come from, and I wanted to be part of promoting that.
One of Mute's first releases would be strangely prescient.
I came across an old Chuck Berry songbook that I had at home, and I thought, oh, would be like, what? I wonder what that sounds like done on synthesizers.
Long distance information, give me Memphis, Tennessee. Help me find a party, trying to get in touch with me.
There were Beatles said, you've got to release it, it's amazing, you know. And I thought, OK, what shall I do? Because I don't think it doesn't kind of fit in under the normal kind of name. And then I just thought, well, what about if there was a group that were all teenagers and their first choice of instrument was a synthesizer rather than a guitar? Because that hadn't happened yet. John Peel, I remember I'd given it to him and I was listening to the radio, I was with a couple of friends, and said, we've got three versions of Memphis, Tennessee tonight. One is the original, there are two cover versions. One is really terrible and the other one's really great. And I thought, oh, God. And fortunately, the way he really liked mine, he played it twice. That was one of the biggest moments of my entire career in the music.
And that's the end of tonight's programme, in which you heard The Desperate Bicycles, The Slits, The Mekons, Alternative TV, The UK Subs and Sham 69. More of the same unpleasant and disorientating racket on tomorrow night's programme. Until then, from me, John Peel, good night and good riddance.
Getting your record on The Peel Show was one thing, but nobody was ready for what happened next.
What sort of makeup do you put on? I mean, you appear very white.
Well, it's all natural, actually. It's Max Factor is a depanstick, and it's 28, which is just natural. It's not a white makeup, it's normal. And then I just powder that with skin tone powder, and then just eyeliner.
On the 24th of May 1979, the future finally arrived. He was a punk. He loved sci-fi. He even read J.G. Ballard. But most impressively, Gary Numan was on Top of the Pops.
I wish magic was real. You know, I wish fairies were real and all that kind of stuff. I love all that sort of thing. Probably never grew up, I suppose, from that point of view.
First time he was on Top of the Pops, I think either she phoned me or I phoned her, are you watching this? Have you seen this man? He's fantastic, you know. The look and the sound was so different. Sort of alien, wasn't it?
I was in a lot of trouble at school. I was sent to child psychiatrists and things like that, which turned out to be apparently Asperger's. I felt more comfortable on my own. The classic loner, I suppose. You know, didn't go out drinking, didn't go out clubbing too much.
So now I'm alone. Now I can think for myself.
I went to a studio to make a punk album, which would have been my first album. And when I got there, in the corner of the studio, there was a Mini Moog. Luckily, it had been left on this sound, which is a huge, big, bassy thing. And the room shook, you know. I just realised you can just press one key and all this other stuff happens. You know, there was a massive amount of power in them and depth that I just never heard anything like it before. One note.
People like ourselves and Cabaret Voltaire and the Human League had all just got used to the fact that we existed and there was somebody else sharing our space. And then along comes, you know, who I guess at the time we thought was Johnny Come Lately. Who the hell is this guy from London who's on telly and having a massive hit record? Never heard of him.
Newman was Britain's first synth pinup.
Hello, Sarah.
Hello, Gary.
Hello, Sarah.
My friend's at the show read in the newspaper that your mum does your hair. Is this true?
Yeah, that's right. She's been doing it since I was about four.
Alright, thank you.
did she put the streak in the side as well?
Yeah.
I really like Gary's music. I think he made the best records at that time. I think he, if anyone, really condensed it into a form that was perfect at that point.
Newman would immediately show that his number one success was no fluke. Cars was part eulogy to J.G. Ballard and part testimony to living in 70s London.
I was in my car and a couple of men in a van swerved around me and pulled up in front, got out and were clearly going to give me a bit of hammering, you know, trying to get me out and kicking the car and screaming and shouting. pretty scared, you know, so I locked on the doors and I ended up driving up onto the pavement and shot along the pavement because I couldn't get any go anywhere. You know, people obviously leaping out of the way because I was in a bit of a panic. Cars is just about feeling safe in amongst people in a car because no one can get to you in your own little bubble. I was gutted when Cars came out. I thought it was really good. All this time we were convinced just a matter of time before we have a number one record because, you know, part arrogance and part stupidity. And then somebody comes out of the blue and does it.
With sales totalling in excess of 10 million, Gary Numan was a new kind of pop star. But being at the front of the synth wave had inevitable drawbacks.
The Musicians Union tried to ban me for, I think, the first year I was around because they said I was putting proper musicians out of work. Although I had to be a member to get on Top of the Pops. So, yeah, caused me loads of grief, actually. The music press were pretty harsh.
It wasn't rock and roll. It wasn't honest, it wasn't working class, it wasn't worthy, it wasn't earthy, it wasn't real, it wasn't sweaty, it wasn't manly, it was pretentious and pseudo-intellectual. And I am absolutely convinced that Newman's career was shortened by nasty, nasty vitriolic journalism.
But again, if what had there been before me? There'd been punk, the whole anti-hero thing. So not only was I doing electronic music, which I wasn't particularly pleased with anyway, but I'm standing up saying, I want to be a pop star. Love it. All this anti-hero stuff that went before that, I had nothing to do with that. You know, I want to be famous and I want to be standing on stages and I don't speak for the people because I don't even know them.
The decade would end with Newman as the unlikely synth-pop hero come good. What lay around the corner would see the synth transformed from post-punk experimental tool into the pop instrument of choice. As dawned, the future finally arrived, and it wasn't going to be alienated. A shift to the right heralded a new era in Britain, an era in which prosperity and material wealth would be vaunted above all else. There would be no room for experimental dreamers in the me decade. You were a success or you didn't exist. The big hit of 1980 was Visage, whose fade to grey followed fast on the heels of Newman's success. It seemed the future had passed the human league by.
I think there were three number one hits. Certainly Dave Stewart and Barbara Gaskin, Gary Newman, and I think the Flying Lizards might have been number one with Money. And I actually stood there after I think we'd done a couple of LPs, but and I thought, we've blown it. We now look like the also-rans, and everyone's taken the idea and done a lot better than us.
The best things in life are free, but you can give them to the birds and bees. I want money.
I turned up at the studio one day to be told that I was being thrown out of the group. And it was a bit like School of Rock, and I, you know, with Jack Black going, you can't throw me out of my own group. We'd released reproduction of Travelogue and done all this touring. There was a nagging undercurrent of dissatisfaction from the record company that they weren't selling as many records as they hoped.
I think I'd made a big effort on a photo session and Martin hadn't even turned up. And suddenly I was hearing these stories that Martin was never ever going to appear on a stage with me again, which I think he only said because that's what Brian Ferry said about Eno in Legend.
Whilst the Human League were crumbling, something was brewing in the most unlikely of places. Basildon was a new town. Built for the post-war East End overspill, it wasn't one of pop music's more romantic places. But a bunch of kids were going to ditch their guitars and reinvent synth music as pop.
When we were growing up, Basildon was a very violent town. We had the highest crime rate for about 5 years on the trot. But I can remember going back to Basildon and going down to the pub with some friends, and I had, like, you know, black nail varnish, going to the bar and ordering a drink. And, you know, I'd totally forgotten about it, wasn't even thinking about it. And some guy just said to me, "What the fuck have you got on your fingernails?"
Depeche Mode formed in 1980. They had a spot at their local disco.
Well, Crops was a really ordinary disco. Well, there was a crocodile, yeah. It was quite a sorry-looking animal, but it was alive. They had this night once a week where they'd play things like the Human League and sort of Sail, and also bands would appear there. Started playing synthesizers, it would have been people like the Human League, Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark, their very first album. I was a big fan of Daniel Miller's work as the Silicon Teens and as the Normal, and also Fad Gadget, who was on Mute Records.
Vince was sort of the boss of the band. He was unbelievably driven. To earn £30 a week in the yoghurt factory and save £29.70, you know, a week, to save up to buy a simp, you know. He forced the pace.
This actually, it was the original Depeche Mode drum machine that we used for live. Dave's job before his song to set the tempo. So number 7 would be fast, number 2 would be slow, etc, etc.
Now, I owned Autobahn. That's what really got us to go out and buy our first synthesizers, the whole, you know, the things that were happening around that time with Kraftwerk and even early Human League stuff.
I was really happy that the first time I heard them was when I saw them play live, because they're fantastic live. They started and I thought, wow, this sounds interesting. It's like four little mono synths kind of teetering on beer crates. They had a little fan base with them, and their fans weren't watching the band. They were just dancing.
Miller first saw Depeche Mode supporting Fag Gadget in East London. He signed them to Mute.
Now, none of us knew what we were doing. By the time I met Depeche, we'd just released our first album. Compared to them, I was an experienced industry person. But actually, I knew nothing. You know, they needed a bit of help in the studio. So I think, you know, first of all, I introduced them to some ways of working, using sequencers. They'd never used a sequencer before. Everything was, like, played by hand. This is the legendary ARP 2600. Bought it second-hand in 1979. It was being sold, one of three being sold by Elton John's road crew after a world tour. Been used extensively on all the Depeche Mode albums I was involved with, especially on the first album, where it was really the one of only two synths that we used. You can hear it going out of tune on that note there. It's not very in tune at all, but...
Depeche Mode would prove to be the real Silicon Teens. The combination of sex appeal and synthesizers would make them one of the biggest pop acts of 1981.
To me.
when Depeche Mode, when we were gigging, we'd all carry our synthesizers, and I, for some reason, you know, had to buy the heavier synthesizer out of all of them, you know, and we didn't have cars or anything, so we'd be on the train, and this really is quite heavy, you know, so I'd have this thing under my arm. Fletcher would have a Moog, Martin had a Yamaha, I think, on the train. So when we did our first Top of the Pops, you know, we were on the trains with these, with our synthesizers.
You got the train to Top of the Pops?
Yeah. From Basildon to Fenchurch Street. In the underground.
But like Newman before, it wouldn't all be plain sailing for Depeche.
I think, you know, you've got to remember that during our pop period, you know, we had lots of fans and a lot of people liked us, but there were a lot of people hated us. But certainly the 80s was a real old battle royal between us and journalism in general, music journalism.
Oh, it was just really, you know, pop. It was, you know, I think I can understand why people hated what we did. You know, looking back on it now, and it wasn't just the sound, it was every TV that we were asked to do, we did. And it didn't matter how stupid it was.
You know, there's something very un-British about electronic music, to start with. They want bands to be like they were in the 60s, really. Four guys, guitar, bass and drums, pretty lead singer, skinny jeans, you know, conventional kind of thing. And that's really what sells newspapers, I guess. Playing on my radio and saying that you had to go. I mean, they'd written Depeche Mode off anyway as a teeny bop band, a one-hit wonder. Especially once Vince left, they thought, well, that's over. No.
In November 81, Clark unexpectedly quit.
I was and still am a bit of a control freak. So, you know, and with the advent of computers and sequences, I realised that I could make all of the music myself. You know, I didn't need necessarily other people to play the parts. And I got a real satisfaction out of programming all of the parts myself.
Without their chief songwriter, it seemed the game was up for Depeche Mode before they really got going. In the same year, a reversal of fortune had seen a new look Human League finally get in on the pop action, partly thanks to a lineup change that took them out of the pages of The Enemy and put them on the front page of Smash Hits.
We got Joanne and Susan simply because we were booked to do a European tour, and Martin and myself became unable to be in the same group, and we just thought, well, got some nice high vocals, yeah, let's try a girl. Let's be a bit different and try a girl. And from that, the step was that if we were going to take a girl on the road with a load of terrible brandy idiots like us, there ought to be two of them to look after each other. And Joanne and Susan turned up. I was being sarcastic there, by the way, with sitting there reading books, really.
Oki spotted the girls dancing in a futurist nightclub in Sheffield.
Our parents thought there's some ulterior motive, something's going on. But then Philip came round and met both sets of parents, and they thought he was a decent enough guy. And then we went to school with our parents, and they talked to the head teacher, who thought that it would be good for our education to have 6 weeks going round Europe, because we could go to art galleries and things like that.
We never went to said art galleries.
We did go to a lot of clubs.
Yeah. We went to Cologne Cathedral too. That was about the most cultural thing we ever did. Get around town where the people look.
It also meant that we could appeal to women as well as men. The early Human League was a very male-based group, and really only lads in long coats liked us. And some transvestites.
OK, pop music, let's go! Anyone here like a human bee?
Released in 81, Dare crystallised the new synth-pop sound.
We did something that could only be done at that stage. While we were doing it, they were bringing the machines in that enabled us to do it. For instance, the very first Lindrum, I think, that arrived in England, came into our studio, and we took the drums off sound of the crowd and put the Lindrum on. And without that, probably it wouldn't have worked.
I mean, I remember when Martin Rushent got the Lindrum, and it was like a child at Christmas getting, you know, the first fire engine or something, and he was jumping up and down, and all the boys were, you know, like, oh, it's a drum, you know, because before that, apparently the drums had been one of the hardest things to do. Mm. And now there was this box that was sort of this big, and you could program it, and they were all very excited, and we were a bit like, OK, boys.
Now the floodgates were open, the rush to market swept every aspect of British life in the early 80s. Everything was now up for grabs, including pop music. In an attempt to eclipse his ex-bandmates, former Human League member Martin Ware would cash in on the times with a concept album.
We were doing the day shifts, they were doing the night shifts in the same studio. They were making Dare, we were making Penthouse and Pavement. I've never been so motivated in my life, believe me. I said, we're going to make it stylish, fantastic. Finally, the shackles are off. We can start using other instruments because it's, you know, the original manifesto is broken. But we're still going to make it predominantly electronic. And so the idea was that suddenly we're not a group. We are ripping open the facade and going, no, this is great music, but it's a business. It really is a business. It doesn't matter, Bob Dylan can sing all he wants. He's busy brown-nosing the A&R man behind the scene. Now here comes my job. With but ironically, and we were totally anti-Thatcher and always have been, you know, fascist groove thing, etc., it got taken on board by the aspirational yuppie culture in the early 80s as their kind of theme tunes a lot of the time, like Let's All Make a Bomb. They completely missed the point of the song, totally, and it's like, yeah, mate, oh, I remember listening to that, yeah, Braces, it's fantastic, mate, love the ponytails.
Not everyone wanted in on booming Britain. Cabaret Voltaire were neither into ponytails nor popularity. Their vision of Britain was concerned with the inner-city riots that erupted across the country in summer 81.
People say that the Special Ghost Town was the soundtrack to the unrest of that year. But a lot of people, you know, alternatively think that Red Mecca was the sound of that. And, you know, I think I've said in the past somehow that insurrection on the streets kind of found its way into the music. Kind of took some heart in the fact that some people were kicking back against the system, albeit in a quite a crude manner, and were prepared to take on the police. You know, we weren't paranoid. This stuff was slowly happening, you know, the rise of surveillance culture, the rise of the, you know, right wing in America, the fundamentalist Christians.
Allah, in the name of Jesus.
And then you got like the revolution in Iran, with the Shah being deposed, and the general feeling that things are moving to the right.
Meanwhile, something strangely synthetic was happening in the sleazy underbelly of London's Soho.
So, yeah. Well, I was going to lots of Northern Soul clubs, so it was kind of, I was listening to kind of Kraftwerk and Northern Soul, which kind of, you know, where things developed from, really, in my head. We had the money, we'd come to Soho and just hang around Soho and just getting ideas, which is why, where the name came from.
Sometimes I feel I've got to run away.
Non-stop erotic cabaret. It was the Raymond Revue Bar back in like 1980 or whatever, and that's where that photograph's from. Because we were just kind of fascinated by being like these two northern hicks in the sticks. And suddenly we're like, wow, this is amazing. It was a sort of, it was kind of glamorous and dangerous and lots of neon lights and stuff, which we were kind of fascinated by.
Now I'll run from you. This tainted love you've given, I give you all a boy could give you. Take my tears and that's not nearly all. Tainted love. Tainted love.
The first people doing the electron thing really kind of came the Alienation, I Am Hollow Inside kind of thing, like Gary Numan. Then you get this sort of second wave where you've got the sort of cold, glistening synth sound, but the singer's actually very, very emotional. Mark Almond's a good example. He's like torridly emotional.
You need someone to hold you tight, and you think love is to pray.
It's like there's a passionate, super passionate singer, and then the one other person, usually a guy with the synthesizer. And I think almost they're kind of using the synth more as like a miniature or condensed orchestra. Like they can get all the sounds they need out of this one box. So really it's more like electronic soul music.
Where Soft Cell led, others would follow. Having left Depeche Mode, Vince Clarke would form his own duo with a rhythm and blues singer, also from Basildon.
Vince, I met for the first time when I was 11. We both went to the same Saturday morning music school. It was a council-run thing where I believe he was playing violin and I was playing oboe. And even though we'd never spoken at that time, I just recognised him for this, the fact there was three of them, three brothers with this white blonde hair looking like little family ducks going across the road, you know.
Once I left Depeche, I had some songs which I wanted to demo for the record company, one of them being Only You.
Looking from a window above, it's like a story of love.
Anyway, I got in touch with Alison because I vaguely knew her. I mean, we didn't have plans to form a band or anything. We had no history together. We just went from the demo to the recording studio to making the first record.
All I needed was the love you gave.
I wasn't overly interested in technology. I couldn't even afford a record player or a cassette player, so the idea of buying hardware was, you know, there's no point in lusting after things you can't have. It's like me thinking about a miniskirt. It was never going to happen.
Listen to the words that you say. It's getting harder to stay when I see you.
Well, Vince Clarke then forms another one of these classic sort of fire and ice groups, you know. The ice is the synth and then the fire is Alison Moyet. So that's almost like a template for 80s pop is, you know, the synthesizer guy, the synthesizer boffin, and then the super passionate singer, usually female or maybe gay male, you know. It's kind of the duo replaces the rock band. You know, it's an affront to rockism, isn't it, that just the look of those bands, you know.
All I needed was the love you gave.
But when we first started working in Yazoo, it was like he was effectively suffering from a very recent divorce.
Only you.
It's like these were his childhood mates, Depeche Mode. You know, this was a huge thing for him to go from being a local boy like the rest of us, without a great deal of hope, without many prospects, you know, without any qualifications. The last thing I'd heard about him is he was driving vans for R. Whites, crashing them and leaving them on the street side.
Yazoo signed to Mute Records in 1982, and to his surprise, Daniel Miller found himself with another wildly successful pop act.
There was nothing right about it. It was quite soulful music with a very cold electronic beat. She didn't fit the typecast female pop star image at all. You know, and it's become a cliche now, but at that time, the quiet second bloke on synth wasn't a cliche.
In the 18 months that we existed, myself and Alison never got to know each other. We never went out to a pub to have a drink or, you know, did any of that stuff, any socialising. It was just in the studio working.
To actually come across somebody who was unfathomable, who you could not penetrate, and at the same time had, regardless of what he said, a burning ambition. You know, he was an ambitious boy. And what was amazing about it is he actually achieved his ambitions, which, again, like I say, coming from where I came from, you didn't see that very often. And I wanted to penetrate him. Not biblically, obviously, but...
I just wanted to be in the studio so much. I just, you know, I would have been in there 24 hours a day. You know, it was like being in a sweet shop.
Synth pop was becoming increasingly popular and increasingly grand. OMD would enjoy three top 10 hits in 1982, two of which were about Joan of Arc.
We were quite intellectual, you know. Pompous, stuck up our own arses, I guess you could say. You know, we were going on Top of the Pops with Bonnie Langford and Elton John and Cliff Richard, amongst others, and we were playing a song that was in waltz time that started with 45 seconds of distortion and had no chorus and had a mellotron playing what sounded like bagpipes.
Well, explain how it works.
Actually, it's fairly straightforward. It's a musical computer, and as you know, Eric, the right hand is lead instruments with a choice of 18 different ones, and the left hand is rhythms in this half and backgrounds in this half, and it's all been fed onto hundreds of tape tracks.
The mellotron is a very, very early sampler before samplers went digital. It was a very analog thing.
Here's a French accordion with a Viennese waltz.
It was a nightmare to use on stage. We were playing in this tiny town in the middle of France, and the mellotron was completely out of tune because all the town were drawing the power down so much cooking. The motor wouldn't spin fast enough.
Thank you. Well, David isn't a musician, as you know, but I have a professional pianist here who can really show you what the mellotron can do.
The number of people who thought that the equipment wrote the song for you. Well, anybody could do it with the same equipment that you've got. Fuck off! It's all played by hand. Believe me, if there was a button on a synth or a drum machine that said hit single, I would have pressed it as often as anybody else would have. But there isn't. It was all written by real human beings, and it was all played by hand, to the point where Paul and I thought we were going to get arthritis in our fingers from playing bass lines like that for hours on end.
Between 1981 and 1983, synth pop reigned supreme. Our charts were chock full of duos and groups who set aside changing the world in favour of making it with a synth on Top of the Pops.
You've got to remember that
It was the first time ever that someone could sit and make a record on their own. Eurythmics came along and they did, I remember, they did Sweet Dreams in the basement. You know, they recorded it on an 8-track tape machine. Annie sang Sweet Dreams into a little Shure microphone, holding it in her hand, you know, and won a Grammy for it.
And in 1982, along came a song that turned the alienation of the original synth pioneers into a full-blown epic.
Ultravox would score like one of the biggest synth pop hits ever, called Vienna, which has that, you know, total fetishism of Middle Europe, you know, Vienna, it's the Habsburg Empire, it's, you know, the romance of Central Europe.
Freezing breath on the window pane, lying and waiting.
The movies we were watching and the music we were listening to at the time, all coming out of Europe, and the history that Europe had, you know, Vienna being this beautifully romantic, you know, city, this beautiful place. And you put all that together, and you've got this fantastic image. You've got this wonderful... I'd never been to Vienna when we wrote the song. You know, I didn't know anything about Vienna. You try putting that down on a piece of paper that you're going to write a song that's a 4.5-minute-long electronic ballad that speeds up in the middle with a viola solo thrown in. It doesn't equate, it doesn't work. But at the time when you're young and, you know, naive, naivety is a wonderful thing.
Not to be outdone by their English synth-pop derivatives, Kraftwerk would return in 1982 to score their only number one single success, cashing in with a song that they'd originally recorded in 1978.
With a model that was in England to be a hit, that was a complete different story. We didn't expect it ourselves. The reason was the following. We had already a single to be played on the radio in England, and it was Computer World. And the man of the EMI London house, he didn't know what to put on the B-side. And he thought, and he thought, and he thought, maybe 2 days longer. And suddenly he had the great idea to put the model from the last album, The Main Machine, on the B-side. And then they sent the single to the radios, and 80% of the radios played the B-side.
She's going out to nightclubs drinking just champagne. By 1983, Britain had entered an era of conspicuous consumption and greed that made the late 70s seem like a foreign country. It would provide inspiration for Depeche Mode's new chief songwriter.
The handshake, silver contract, from the contract, there's no turning back. The turning point of a career in Korea.
The early 80s were just a terrible time in Britain. And I was young and impressionable, and you know that was really when I first felt like I was, you know, sort of writing from the heart, really. Around the time of Construction Time Again, samplers had just really come out. So, you know, it was just a whole revelation to us. We were just going out and, you know, sort of like smashing pieces of metal with sledgehammers, you know, raiding the kitchen drawer for all the utensils to make percussion sounds, just anything we could get our hands on.
We've got this vague idea at the moment, which was used on the demo. We've got this pebble. We got from the mud.
Yeah, look, white spots, heavy, stinging nails.
Anyway, the idea is to roll the pebble on this piece of metal along here, this window frame, thus causing, thus making this sort of sound.
Construction Time Again really started to see us form, you know, as the basis of what we are today.
That was a lot better. Anyway, and the idea is to take that sequence and to make an interesting rhythm out of it, and to sequence it all through the song, you know, so people dance.
Depeche Mode pioneered their new sampler-based sound in London's Shoreditch.
In those days, Shoreditch was there was not a soul around, but now, of course, with Hoxton, etc., etc., it's sort of like the trendy place to be. But it wasn't when we were at the Garden Studios. It was not a soul to be seen.
I remember there was one sound in particular that was us actually hitting a piece of corrugated iron that was the side of a building site, and the sample sort of went like, "Oi!" And there was like the site foreman, you know.
It's a lot. 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 It's a lot.
We seemed from the 80s really to be doing a one-band crusade for electronic music, you know. Against the music press that was overwhelmingly rock-based.
We would often do interviews with journalists and we'd have a big argument because they just didn't consider electronic music to be real music. Accused a bit at certain times of being like a very subversive pop band, and I do think that we did get away with, you know, some stuff that was, you know, probably risque for the radio just because we used it in a pop context. In our early career, I mean, there are things like, you know, Master and Servant and stuff.
The reviews, they were unbelievably vicious. I mean, you just couldn't, you know, real hatred for the band. Real hatred. I don't know why. It wasn't British, really.
A journalist once said that, you know, the music will appeal to alienated youth everywhere and Germans.
Depeche Mode would eventually find a sympathetic home for their music in America.
For a lot of Americans, England just means gay. It's just like, you know, they think it's like a conflation of Oscar Wilde and various ideas about British boarding school. For people who feel different or misfits in America, England does actually seem like this utopia. They imagine everyone in England walks around wearing eyeliner and plays synthesizers, you know. And so to be a Depeche Mode fan in America was actually quite a sort of dissident thing.
Depeche Mode were the only act who were truly successful in exporting the British electronic sound. The band would enjoy massive popularity in America throughout the 80s and beyond, consistently filling stadiums across the land. Back in Britain in 83, the sampler was moving synth pop in a different direction.
Suppose I want to send my loved one a rather special musical greeting. Well, I can. First, let me give the computer an idea of the sound that I actually want to send. So I'll prime it again. And now I'll speak into the mic. Hello! And we have to wait a couple of seconds now for the sound wave to come up. There it is.
Hello!
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 Hello, dear.
When we arrived in it, the emulator had just been invented. And it was completely riveting because it had James Brown going, please, you know, and you could play up and down the keyboard. It had a string quartet or an orchestra. It had the famous Beethoven rumph, rumph. And so the first record we made, Western Girls, every single sound was actually a sample played on the same keyboard, which looked just like a little Bon Tempi chord organ. The idea is to take real life and put it against beautiful or danceable or both music. Because we were the last of the thing that started with the Human League, and we were probably the first of the thing where pop music was related to dance music.
The Pet Shop Boys gave us a glimpse of what the future held for British electronic music. But the band that would truly spearhead the shift from synth-pop to dance music had evolved out of the ashes of Joy Division. Whilst in America, New Order would have a synthetic epiphany.
Kind of a period where Ian had died and we were going... The recording in New York, we spent a lot of time in New York, and I was going to nightclubs after the studio every night. I remember sitting there on these kind of steps in a club and thinking, wouldn't it be great if one day our music was played in a place like this? That sort of planted a seed in my head, really, that got me interested in more than synthesizers. You know, if you play an encore or something, we were, you know, punks, and it's like, you're just falling into the trap, you know. It's a phony thing doing an encore, everyone expects it, you know. And, let's get these machines to do a track and we'll just go on. If we do an encore, press a button and then bugger off, you know. That was the idea. When Blue Monday came out, a lot of people didn't like it, you know, like, it doesn't sound like New Order, you know, it doesn't sound like New Order, what are you doing, you know, it doesn't sound like you're supposed to sound, and a lot of people like, don't like that, and then it just took off. How does it feel to treat me like you do? I guess people went on holiday, they would hear it in nightclubs in Spain and Greece and stuff, and then it'd come back, when it came back, we'd buy it, and it'd be a big hit over and over again, you know.
Blue Monday's inscrutable club cool would help it become the biggest selling 12-inch of all time. Originally released in 1983, it heralded the future for British electronica, a new age of dance music. Unconcerned with pop charts and commercial appeal, would gain a massive following that thrives to this day. For those electronic pioneers who had brought the synth into British pop music, it was the end of an era.
It sort of starts, I guess, around about 83. It was just overdone, it was saturated, there was too much synth pop around. It's all very well it was being on the synth, but actually the actual melodies and the way the songs were structured were really pretty traditional and quite trite, you know. It wasn't that inventive as electronic music.
Towards the middle of the 80s, there was not so much encouragement from the record companies to do more experimental stuff. I mean, that initial supernova of post-punk it was dying away, and slowly but surely the cancerous growth of market-led A&Ring started invidiously creeping up and blandifying and homogenising the musical market, in my view.
Well, we were a bit lost by then. It was all a bit... We felt we'd achieved it. We thought we'd proved our point, and it just looked like we'd... We didn't have anything left to prove.
The commodification of synth-pop marked the end of a golden era in which a generation of post-punk musicians had taken the synth from the fringes of experimentation to the centre of the pop stage. Out of the 70s and into the 80s.
At time, it was just really, really exciting. And it was exciting to be a part of a musical movement that had never been done before, that was completely different. It wasn't a rehash of anything. Those early electronic records, I mean, they'd never been done before, so it was a fine time.
We were trying to do something new. That's specifically why we chose electronics and embraced every new piece of equipment we could get our hands on or afford. We wanted to sweep away all of the old rock cliches and the stereotypes and the lead guitar solos and long hair and everything. And then what happens towards the end of the 80s and even worse in the mid-90s, everybody decides that guitars are back in, synthesizers are somehow old-fashioned, and you get Oasis. Horror.